training in perfect dharma is rarely met with even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I feel like I'm a little bit down in a hole here, but somehow this feels like I'm lower. Why does it feel like I'm lower? Oh, maybe because we're spread out. That's right. You're kind of. I can't see the people in the back so well. That's why. Okay. So I'm sort of committed to going through the kind of 56 aphorisms of Tisha. And we started last week, and I didn't have my little recorder on, so I'm going to do a little review. And just so I can get it, I'd like to get it on the website, because we're going to be staying with this for some weeks now, probably through the end of June. Anyway, would be my guess. And I think it would be very helpful. I'm hoping that what you'll be able to do is pick out a couple that'll stick with you, that'll particularly resonate with you. And you know, our meditation is very vast and expansive, and but as we go through our life, we need little things to kind of keep us back on track. And I like these, just like I like cones. They have a little bit of a sense of humor to them, and I found them, some of them to be very useful, and I'm hoping that you will find some of them to be very useful. So our teacher was 11th century Indian pundit and Buddhist teacher, went to Tibet and taught these aphorisms, which are really, I think that really you'd say they're the heart of Tibetan practice, of heart practice, basis of Tonglin and metta, and how to be in the world, called the Pith teachings. And I'm using a couple of books. Kensei's book, who died in 91. He's a Tibetan teacher, more of a traditional approach. Wonderful book. It should be everybody bookshelf. Pema Chodron's 108 teachings. You know, you can just pick any. She doesn't do it sequentially, and she kind of reorganizes it. But some of the aphorisms are almost verbatim in here, but very much a contemporary way. And she took these teachings from her teacher, Trungpa, Chogyam Trungpa. I understand Alan Wallace, who's a really wonderful scholar. He has a book out, too, that I haven't looked at. He's quite a good teacher. So we were saying that what these aphorisms are doing is they're training for people, helping us to see how to actualize being a bodhisattva in our life. And as I read these, I see really that this teacher is drawing on Shanti Deva's work. And those of you that took that class that we did, a couple of years ago on Shanti Deva, the teachings, the Bodhicharya Vatara, about how to be a bodhisattva, that a lot of these aphorisms are taken from actually, you can see that he in fact is drawing on Shanti Deva's work. And last week we kind of reviewed what a bodhisattva was. I remember, Bob, you were saying you try to clarify and purify the mind with the idea not just for our own liberation, but we're doing it because we really believe that the path of clarity of mind is the best way to help people. But the other way to say it also is that we begin to see a natural culmination of our practice. We start off by just trying to relieve our stress and our anxiety, but we begin to see as we practice that the fruit of the practice, or the natural consequence of the practice, is to open our heart. And to open our heart means we have to continually erode our self-centered way of being with other people. And so that's our path. We, you know, in some ways you could say it's a little selfish. It feels better when our heart is open. And our heart can't be open if we're self-centered. And we say, oh, we wake up and see the reality of that. And so we feel when we contract and become self-centered, and our intention is to open our hearts. And to open our hearts, we need to extend to other people and include other people. So that's why the natural consequences to do metta practice, loving kindness, and actually just to actualize in the world with kindness towards others. And that we talked a little bit about that the mind that that we cultivate to become a bodhisattva is called bodhicitta. And there were kind of two aspects that the Tibetans present to us, which are actually quite useful, really, kind of as provisional terms, all terms, is absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta. Absolute being that expansive, broad nature of our mind, and then we take that and we apply it in very practical applications in terms of how we relate to other people. And the quote that I used was, "Meditation on emptiness, or absolute bodhicitta, without compassion is not the Mahayana path, but also meditation on compassion without emptiness is also not the path." So it's a matter of being able to balance absolute and relative bodhicitta, so to speak, or the open, expansive nature of our meditative being with the practical application in our everyday life. And then we went into we actually went into the text itself a little bit. The first is study the preliminaries, and then consider all phenomena as a dream, analyze the unborn nature of awareness. The antidote will vanish of itself. The nature of the path rests in the alaya. In post-meditation, consider phenomena as illusionary and train to give and take alternatively. So the first phrases are dealing with absolute bodhicitta, and then they're bringing us to a place of where train to give and take alternatively. That's Tonglen practice. So you start with preparing the ground, practicing absolute bodhicitta, and then after you've done that, then you move into Tonglen practice, or the actual experience of communicating and relating to other people in life. And the basis for studying the preliminaries were to focus on how important it is right now that this human birth is important. What you're given right now, don't waste your time. Get your priorities straight. That what the text is saying is trying to cultivate as many friends as possible, wealth, power, recognition, all the mundane things that we're trained and we direct ourselves toward are not the most important thing. The most important thing is liberation, and to use this very life and this very time to actually try to awaken, to be awake to what's really important in life. And we do this by also understanding about the impermanent nature of our very existence. So we're not actually going to be around as long. So we should use our time judiciously and skillfully. And the second part of studying the preliminaries was understand the effect of cause and effect, which simply means that, you know, in reality, most of us are oriented towards seeking pleasure and avoiding pain. And that we seek security, and we don't understand that basically things are impermanent, and that we don't understand that it's important to take refuge in groundlessness. Groundlessness is a fearful concept for us. The text is trying to get us to reorient what our priorities are. And part of the preliminary practices, which are usually taught, are, one, you need to develop concentration in your meditation practice so you can, you sort of narrow so you can expand, that you become incredibly honest with yourself in terms of your shortcomings, and a more transparent in terms of, yes, this is the way I am, this is where I tend to close down, these are the things that I'm working on, and that you then begin to direct yourself in terms of your meditation practice and in terms of just being kind in the world, and that whatever merit accrues to you because of your practice, you dedicate that merit, which is an important part of our practice. You don't do it for recognition or I'm a good person, can't you see I'm a good person, that everything you transform back into offering merit to everybody else. Whatever merit accrues to you, you offer that merit up, which is a very important part of the practice. And then we move to the next aphorism, which was absolute bodhicitta. Consider all phenomena as a dream. So that's the part where we really start to take, Suzuki Roshi said, the heart of Buddhist practice is really trying to penetrate impermanence. In our meditation, every thought that goes through, we see, we begin to gain increasing insight that all thoughts, all body sensations are impermanent. And we reflect more deeply on the fact that everything, in fact, comes and goes. And in this practice, we deepen our sense of reality, and this is the way life is. And that through this, we gain a tremendous sense of equanimity in life. Yesterday, I was with my sister, who, as you know, is recovering, a cancer survivor, we hadn't seen each other for about 8 months, so we spent the day together. And I took her to a nursery, Quarry Hill Nursery. You ever been there? It's a great nursery. You should go visit it. It specializes in Chinese plants. Then we went over to Jack London, and I took her to the museum, Wolf House. But I don't know if you've ever been there, but I had never been to the original house that Jack London built. Had anybody ever visit that? I'd never seen that. And it was actually a powerful experience because I was reflecting a little bit about the lecture today, and he built this incredible house, and it was like kind of a miniature Awani Lodge. It was right after the earthquake, and so the foundations are so strong, they could support like a 40-story building or something. It was incredibly immense, with trunks of redwood trees. And his quote was, "I am building a structure that, God willing, will last for 1,000 years. That's what his intention was. A month before he moved in, it burned to the ground. A month before he moved in. The quote, "I'm going to build it, it's going to last for 1,000 years. And you can walk and see the shell. You can still see the stone structures, the first two stories of stone structure. And then all the wood burned. And they think that they were actually coating the wood with linseed oil, and they left the linseed oil rags, and some spontaneous combustion actually ignited it. But I just reflected, and as you walk through, his sense of life energy, just how ephemeral, how just, and he burned in 1960, and then he died 3 years later. He never really recovered from that sense of loss. So I think maybe if he'd had a little more practice, in the sense of that, he could, of course, grieve. We grieve on one side. And on the other side, he could understand more. And I don't know if you've experienced this in your life. Another way that I experience impermanency is often when I go a trip, I do a trip. It's so intense to get a trip together. You have to plan and organize, and you got to pack, and it's just all this intense energy. And then you go and you do the trip, and it's so intense, and there's so many vivid and incredible memories that you have, and you have to be so present to kind of deal with the reality of getting on trains and buses and meeting. And then you come back, and did it really happen? Like 2 weeks later, did it really happen? Did I really do this? Or maybe you experience that around Christmas, you know, all the energy gets together, and then 2 days after Christmas or a week later, it's like, did that really happen? So there's something, there's an advantage to reflecting like that. You're able to let go a little bit more. So that's what they're saying is consider all phenomena as a dream. So in the heart, when it says in the Diamond Sutra, like a flash of lightning, like a bubble in a stream. That's what they're trying to encourage you a little bit, to be able to let go a little bit more easily. The next one is the one I wanted to focus on a little bit. It's, you know, one of my favorite. Analyze the unborn nature of awareness. So that sounds a little esoteric. Analyze the unborn nature of awareness. Now that's actually the heart of our practice, of Zen practice and Dzogchen practice and Mahamudra practice, the Tibetan practices, tend to emphasize the unborn nature of awareness. So most of the Zen koans that I work with you with point in that direction. They're trying to get you to see beyond the usual discursive operations of our mind. So some of the koans that I worked with you with, you know, one of my favorites is when Tozan is talking with his disciple and they're having a discussion, kind of maybe the practicalities of practice of monastery, and as the disciple's leaving, he hands him a lantern. Remember the story? And then just as he's walking off into the darkness, the teacher goes over and he blows the candle out. And his disciple has great awakening. Suddenly having an insight into that unborn nature of awareness, that sense of mind that is just present beyond the usual patterns of our thinking, of planning and strategizing. And this is what we work with in our particular type of meditation. We watch the mind, but as it stills and our concentration develops, we begin to see the gaps between our thinking, and we begin to see that the thoughts are playing out against a bigger background. And as our meditation deepens, we begin to have more of a sense of being able to drop into this background. So when one of the first koans that's usually assigned to people is, what is your original face? That means, what is your original mind? What is this mind? What is this mind that is the just consciousness, just awareness? And so this particular aphorism is encouraging us to think and explore that a little more deeply. I mean, not only just in our meditation practice, which is the only way you can really experience it experientially, is in meditation, you know, or being aware in life, which is what meditation is, but we reflect this consciousness that we have that receives and processes information. This awareness, does it have a color? Does it have a form? Does it have a beginning? Does it have an end? Where does it abide? Does it abide inside? Outside? Does it abide in our bodies or our minds? And the more we begin to reflect on this, we see that we can't pin it down. There's nowhere we can find it. Right? Just present right now. No thinking. Just awareness. Where do you find that awareness? How can you define it? So this would be another way to think about emptiness. It's another way of kind of thinking about emptiness. And we get little glimpses of this. As Suzuki Roshi says, I was reading a little quote from him last week, occasionally we get postcards from emptiness. We get little postcards that come from this place of awareness in our meditation practice and just being aware and alive in our lives. We begin to have flashes of insight into this. Analyze the unborn nature of awareness. And the more that we are able to abide in this unborn nature of awareness and take refuge born in impermanence, the less we suffer. Because the less we hang on to our concept of the way things ought to be and the way we're able to just let things come and go. So the next antidote is, the antidote will vanish of itself. So what that means is, when we were studying the Heart Sutra a couple months ago and we came across the phrase, there is neither, in the middle, there is neither ignorance nor extinction of ignorance, neither old age and death nor extinction of old age and death, no suffering, no cause, no sensation, no path, no knowledge, no attainment. With nothing to attain, the bodhisattva relies on prajna paramita, and thus the mind is without hindrance. So we abide in the unconditioned nature of our mind, but we have to let that go too. We have to let go the concept of even the antidote of emptiness, or even the concept, we can't, anything we try to do to define this open, expansive nature of our mind is going to limit it. And so that's what it's saying. You have to let go even of that. Don't even try to hang on to that. Don't even try to take refuge in that. So let go. The antidote will vanish of itself. I mean, I like the way they phrase that. It's like, if you really, the deeper you reflect on it, you'll see that that itself, as long as you're hanging on to that, it's still something in your mind. It's still the foreground, and you're not referencing on the background. So the next antidote is, the nature of the path rests in the alaya. So that's a little esoteric, because you don't, most of you don't know what the alaya is, but the definition of the alaya would be the Buddhist, a little bit of the Buddhist definition of what the unconscious is. It just means that every action, every thought that you have has a karmic implication, right? Which we all know that part, right? We can see that, the nature of cause and effect. But it means that it rests in what they call the alaya vijnana, which is the stored consciousness. And that out of the stored consciousness comes our conditioned nature, how we actually are in the world. It programs. How we're programmed, our conditioned nature arises out of this vast store consciousness, which is not only what we've done in our life, but of course what the Tibetans would say has happened in previous lives. But as a therapist, you know, I can say, and I think you all know, that you have been conditioned by your mother and father, right? Your mother and father abide in you, and you need to accept that and work with it, because it's in there. As much as you don't want to acknowledge it, unless you had a bodhisattva for mother and father, you know, that abides in you too. That conditioning abides in you too. So we take responsibility for that. But the way I interpret this, it means that we're starting to move now. The first aphorisms are moving you into absolute bodhicitta, this absolute unconditioned nature. Everything is perfect the way it is, in some way. Now we're starting to move more into the relative world, the world into form, you know, into specific form. And so it's saying that the nature of the path actually abides in this. The way that we make contact, we're just, our senses are awake, they're alert, we make contact with the world, and then we begin to analyze that. We begin to put our own conditioning from the alaya, our unconscious, onto that. And then we begin to contract, we begin to do whatever our maneuverings are to avoid pain and uncertainty. And that, in the very nature of that process, is how we awaken. We have to use the that material to awaken. That's why the nature of the path comes out of actually our suffering and our conditioning. We need it. We need it to actually awaken. And that's actually the nature of the path relies in the alaya, is that's how we, Bruce, you, come into existence. The sense of I, the sense of ego, comes into existence in terms of how we define ourselves out of our conditioning. So we work with it. We see when our anger arises out of our conditioning, and we begin to apply the teachings of impermanence, of the unconditioned nature of it, and we work with it. We begin to lessen the impact of that in our lives. But, you know, we need circumstances to actually activate that sometimes so we can work with it. The next one is, as we're starting to move more now into relative bodhicitta, is in post-meditation, consider phenomena as illusion. So that's just a variation on the one before, where you're seeing phenomena as illusion. They're saying now, as you're coming out of absolute bodhicitta, out of this space of where you're blissed out in meditation and you're very concentrated and you're just with your breath and you're just with being, and now you go out and, you know, somebody gets irritated with you and honks the horn at you and you lose it, you know, that you remember what you learned while you were meditating, while you were abiding in absolute bodhicitta. It's insane. Now, don't just say, okay, on the cushion you have it. Now you have to bring it into your everyday life. In post-meditation, consider phenomena as illusion. Actually consider the impermanent nature and the ramifications of impermanent nature, about the interconnectedness, you know, that we are connected with people. Begin to actualize that into your life. And then the next one now is we're moving into relative bodhicitta. Train in giving and taking alternatively. So that's Tonglen practice. So I would like to, for the next 10 minutes, I would like to review with you Tonglen practice by actually doing it with you. So now we're actually going to go into a specific practice about how to cultivate relative bodhicitta. But to do that, we have to be grounded in foundations, and we have to be grounded into absolute bodhicitta. So the way it's taught is you start off with absolute meditation, which is the meditation that we do. Our normal meditation cultivates absolute bodhicitta. So we're going to do about 3 minutes or so of absolute bodhicitta, and I'm going to just give you some brief guided meditations on it, and then I'm going to move you into the way I start people off with Tonglen, which is a little different than it is traditionally, and then I'm going to move you into how it's taught traditionally, which is basically taking the difficulty you experience in yourself or other people, and you visualize it as dark or black. And this is hard. You're going to meet resistance. See, I already can see people expressing, they're starting to contract around this. You take it in as black, and then you transform it into light. So remember, with every religious practice, almost every one, you're going to meet resistance. This is true. If I was going to teach like bowing practice to you, most people would meet resistance. You know, in a practice about having an exchange with a teacher, for example, you'll meet resistance in that. In your meditation practice, you've met resistance, and you continue to meet resistance. You want to get up, right? It's hard to discipline yourself to do a lot of these practices. So know that Tonglen is no different. You will meet some resistance. So, of course, one of the aphorisms we'll meet later is, of the two witnesses, you're the primary. That means ultimately you have to decide if this is the right practice for you. And it may not be. And that'll be your decision. But you have to stay with it for a while to make that decision. So, absolute bodhicitta. We start with our body. Just getting in touch. Something very specific, actually. Ground in our body. Feeling our chest, our stomach. bringing us into the present moment with our breath rising and falling at our tummy. And then we would begin to stabilize our minds. Possibly, you know, usually I recommend maybe counting a little bit. We won't stay with that too much because we've already been sitting for a while. But maybe count to 5 or 10 with the out-breath. Letting the thoughts as they come in, just letting them go. Seeing if you can get in touch more with the background through your breath. Maybe dropping the counting after a while. And now just starting to brighten the breath a little bit. Feel the beginning of the in-breath, the middle, and then the exhale. Deepening our concentration of the inhale and the exhale. And then brightening the breath even more, becoming the breath. See if you can just become the breath. Lose yourself in the breath. As soon as a thought starts to come in, just let it go. Don't resist, just let it go. Staying with the body, feeling the breath. And then maybe, you know, if we practice and our concentration becomes deeper, maybe we can even let go of the breath. Go beyond the breath. Just be. Just be. Open, expansive awareness. Sights, sounds, thoughts come, pass through. Open, vast. Including everything. Absolute bodhicitta. So now that we've expanded, first of all, we've kind of contracted on the breath and we begin to expand through our concentration. Now we've taken this awareness of absolute bodhicitta. Now we start to come and we start to apply it more into relative bodhicitta. So a metta practice would be an example of how to do that. But we're going to work on Tonglen a little bit. So now just start to take your awareness. And the first step would be just to kind of sweep your body gently, compassionately. And feel if there's any contraction or heaviness in your chest, your stomach, your jaw, your head, your eyes. If you feel any contraction or begin to breathe into that. feel it on the in-breath. Don't try to change it. Just feel it and then breathe into it with compassion. Any constriction, contraction. Relax into it. And then see if what arises is some difficulty that is tied to that physical contraction, or maybe it will just, you don't access it through the physical, maybe you just know that there's some problem in your life, some heart constriction with your partner, a friend, some fear, some anxiety that you carry, that we all carry as part of the human predicament. Now feel it on the in-breath and then breathe light and compassion into it with the out-breath. Don't think about it. Don't try to figure it out. Just be with the raw sensation and breathe light and healing into it. You're being very compassionate with yourself now. You're identifying the problem, the constriction, and you're breathing into it. Thoughts will take us away. It's okay, just bring it back. Now I'm going to switch to a more traditional way to teach, and this will be a little hard for some of you, but you can also visualize what you're experiencing, the difficulty in your life, as kind of more dark or smoky, because that's the way it is. It obscures our clarity. Dark, smoky. So you feel it, the anxiety, the depression, the worry, the problem. See it as dark, smoky, but breathe it in still with a sense of feeling it. But as you breathe it in, transform it to light, and then breathe out light or what you need, what the antidote is. Maybe finding the word, the antidote word, like open, let go. Or maybe just visualizing light, brightness. So the power of bodhicitta has the capacity to transform what is dark and obscure into diamond brightness. That's the practice. If it's too hard to visualize dark, then you can just go back to just feeling it. But stay with it for a while. See where it takes you. Transforming into light. And give up an expectation that's going to change. Just stay with it. Trust in the process. Seeds are planted. Healing is encouraged. Openness is requested. So the next step, and you could do this, you could only just do this part of Tonglen. But as in metta, you could go to the next. Go to somebody who you have some affection for. Some person you have some warm-hearted feeling for, and know what their suffering is. Now actually breathe in their suffering as dark, as smoky. Breathe it in. Feel it. Feel their suffering. Let it touch your heart. And with the power of bodhicitta, transform it and send it back to them as light, healing, or what they need. If they need, if you think, often it's easier just to stay in light. Be careful not to be judgmental, or just like a, not move into pity. Just maybe if they just need to let go, you could just go send it with that wish, let go, ease. No judgment, just wanting, wishing goodwill. So in the next week, do this. But before we end, come back now. When you do Tonglen, you come back, you start with Absolute, and then you come back to Absolute. So now just come back to your breath. The open awareness, expansive awareness of your being. Contact it through your breath. Breathing in. And breathing out, open, expansive, letting go of concepts, identities. So, I'd encourage you to try Tonglin. Just like Metta, you'll find resistance to it. If you find it too difficult to do breathing in black or dark, you can just do, you know, just feel it. Just be with it. And also, I'd encourage you to do what Pema Chodron calls on-the-spot Tonglin, which means that you're standing there with somebody and you're feeling that they're kind of uptight or angry, agitated. Maybe you're, you know, with somebody, you know, sick in bed. And you just breathe in. You don't have to say anything. You just breathe in. Breathe it in. Breathe in, and then, you know, breathe in their agitation. And this is hard. This is hard because usually we think, wait a minute, I'm agitated enough. I don't need to breathe in any additional agitation. Right? This is what's hard about this practice. You know. But actually, it's transformative. That's the whole purpose of bodhicitta practice, is the more we can extend beyond our own sense of suffering. We don't just, like, take care of all our suffering and then we go out. You know, we breathe it in and we extend it. But remember, the wonderful thing about Buddhist concept of compassion is often in the West, it's like, here's me, here's you, and I'm going to be compassionate towards you. It's not the idea in Buddhism. Buddhism is like, me and you are together. I can't be compassionate. I have to be compassionate for myself, too. So if you're feeling like it's a little off balance, then go back and do Tonglin for yourself. Or you could alternate for yourself and someone else. I mean, you could play with it a little bit. But also try it on the spot Tonglin. Just sitting there, feeling yourself getting agitated with it, and just start to breathe it in. And just send back to them what they need. And see how it actually tenderizes your heart. Okay. Do you have any questions about it? Anything you'd like to share about how that was for you? Was it okay? Did it work for you? Did you feel a little something? Yeah, it's pretty wonderful practice. So we'll be doing it again. We'll be, as we go through these aphorisms, we'll come back and reground in this very specific practice of Tonglin. Yes.
So in doing Tonglin for yourself, say you're feeling agitation.
Yeah.
You'd be breathing out, visualizing your feeling as gray or dark.
And no, you breathe it in. So you actually breathe it in and feel it. One way to say it would feel on the in-breath. Be with, just like a little child, you know, like crying, mm-hmm. just like you just, yes, I'm here for you. That spirit. I just want to be here for you and comfort you. Mm-hmm. You feel it, you bring it in. You bring it in. And then on the out-breath, you send to it what it needs. It's like if you're constricted, anger, you're constricted. So you just feel it. You just be with the raw feeling. Don't get into trying to figure it out. This person did this person did that, I have a right to be angry. You're approaching it at a different level. You're just feeling it, and then what do you need? Openness, light, whatever, maybe a word comes to you, then you breathe that out. So same thing, you do it with yourself, just like you're treating yourself as the object, same as you would do with somebody else. Is that clear? Mm-hmm. Breathe in, feel, breathe out what you need. Or the antidote. And you can be creative with the antidote. And sometimes you'll start with one antidote and it'll lead you to another. Remember, you don't need to do anything than just to feel, like, goodwill. You don't need to go beyond that. But if you want to, like, you could say open or let go. And you could just try that for a while. Breathe in, tense, out, let go. And then the word may switch to another word. And that would be important to see where that word takes you. So that's just a permutation of how to do the practice. That can be very useful. Any other questions? Okay, so let's see. We'll meet back there next week. And then we're getting ready on the 6th. There will be a Jukai for Bonnie and Richard ceremony where we do the lay ordination for people who have been sowing the Roksu. And on the, Michael?
Yes.
And the sitting will be on?
I believe it's the 30th, two weeks from today.
And that will be on the Sunday. So we'll, on Sunday, 2 weeks, we'll do Buddha's birthday celebration. We haven't done that. So we'll set up an altar, and then we bathe the Buddha. And Larry has kindly consented to lead off. So while people are lined up offering incense, Larry's going to bring a couple poems that he think would be appropriate. But the rest of you, if other people would like to bring poems, you could bring it, and then you recite it as people are going up. So we'll start with Larry, and then if you read any, and if you don't get a chance to read your poem, then we'll carry it over. We'll give you a chance the following week or week after. So, yes.
Is that at your house? There,
no, no, that'll be at the teen center. I did have it.
You did have something.
I did. I had it scheduled at my house, and I let go of that.
This is May 30th?
Yeah, it'll be at the teen center. We'll do it at the teen center. Yeah, we're not going to have
a,
we're not going to have a spring party. Too much going on for me.
Will we meet here again next time?
No, we'll meet at the teen center.
Yeah.
Yeah, and on the 30th we'll meet at the teen center.
And the timing is the same?
And the timing is the same. And the Jukai will be the same. Yes.
Is there a theme to the poetry that you want us to stay with, or just...
Something that stirs your heart, but it's Buddha's birthday. So, you know, whatever, you know, spring, birth, resurrection, opening, light, you know, just whatever, it's like that. Yeah. Okay? Yes, Meg.
But then after Buddha's birthday, we're going to be sitting at Connie's.
Oh, yes. That's an important point. Well, Buddha's birthday, 30th, at the teen center, and then after that, people that would like to, yes, thank you, will go to Connie's house, and will sit with Bonnie and Richard in solidarity until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And if you want to come just for an hour or two, that's fine. What are we doing about lunch?
People are bringing their own lunch.
People are bringing their own lunch.
And there are flyers in the back, too, that show the schedule.
Oh, okay.
So that if you can only come for part, you can see what parts.
Yeah, so you can just drop in for an hour, or you can sit the whole, you know, sit till 3 if you want.
Flyers also have Connie's address on it, if you haven't been there before.
Yeah. Is that, would you get that covered? Okay.
And they're in the back. Okay. The donation box.
Okay. On the spot, Tomlin. Thank you all.